What's up? What's up? It's the members only episode. How's it going, Robbie the Fire Bernstein?
I'm well. How are you, my friend?
Very good. Very good. I cannot complain. I had a nice morning with the family. What do you got? You gigging this weekend?
Oh, I got so many porches. I got Raleigh, Hampstead, and Myrtle Beach. And then next weekend is July 4th, I think. So I'm doing nothing. I'm actually stopping. I'll be in Newport, Rhode Island with my family, hopefully writing jokes about how much I hate them. Although I never seem to come up with anything. I seem to just be around them and irritated, thinking that some good joke will come about family dynamics. And
it's coming. It's coming.
I guess that's a serial killer thing about being a comic, that you'll be like, yeah, I know I don't really want to do this, but it's a human thing to do, so I should try and maybe I'll get a joke out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a lot of that early in my comedy career. And there is also, and look, I got a lot of jokes out of it, but there's a lot of times where you go like, listen, I'm going to go do this weird thing that's going to make me feel uncomfortable, but I'll get a good joke out of it. And then you just don't.
Yeah.
And then you're just like, oh, I just did that for no reason.
It's also not supposed to be vacation with your family.
Yeah.
It's probably, not supposed to be in that category, but yeah.
It's not helping anything. That's for sure. But hey, go enjoy it. It's the 250th anniversary of the country. And I think
I think they do good fireworks out there.
Yeah.
That's okay. I can forget about that if I'm eating a hot dog and looking at good fireworks.
Fireworks while ignoring all of the impending doom does seem like the most American thing possible. Like, that sums it up more than anything else. But shit's exploding in the sky, dude. So just relax.
Last year we had the funnest porch show for 4th of July, and we launched our own fireworks, which I can't even explain how much more fun that is than watching other people do fireworks. But the highlight was I bought this $200. I literally spent more than I think I made in tickets that night on fireworks because I'm stupid, and that's what stupid people do.
It doesn't characterize MIT graduates. Yes, that is true. And I mean, I'm saying it's not like if you go for the trait of a genius, is typically they take more than the money they made for the weekend and spend that much on fireworks. It wouldn't be the first thing. Sure.
No, this was particular. I learned 4th of July is not a great gigging weekend because everyone's doing 4th of July stuff.
Oh yeah. Terrible. And
yeah. So I learned not to, amongst the stress of, oh, none of the shows went well, I also spend more than that night's money just on fireworks.
Yeah.
And one of the firework boxes did not go off, which was a big disappointment because it was like a $200 box, and the first one was really cool. And the highlight of my 4th of July was firing Roman candles at the fireworks box to try and get it to go off.
That does sound fun.
Yeah. It didn't go, but that was a fun drunken activity.
Fireworks were a lot of fun. They were a big fireworks when I was a kid, firecrackers, fireworks. That was like the whole thing. And it was, you know, and then they shut it down, I suppose, because, you know, a few kids too many blew their hands off or whatever. But it was kind of like, it was the children's version of like growing up in the Industrial Revolution or something like that. Like, you can't scare, you'd be like, oh, there's a horror story of like a guy got his hand chopped off by a machine at a factory. And you're like, yeah, no, we knew what it was. You know, like, obviously this was, if you did this on scale, that there were going to be incidents. But man, was it fun.
The dumbest thing I ever did with the firework was in Connecticut at one point, they legalized like the fake fireworks that still stay on the ground, but kind of like really sparkle, like more advanced sparklers, I would call them. And there's this one called a Piccolo Pete that made like a noise like a missile was going off. Like, it was like a loud shrieking sound. And I lived in a dorm, and this dorm in high school. Oh, this is so stupid. You're going to love how stupid this is.
I'm already glued to this story.
The dorm had a box that went into another building. And so there was a big open pit in the middle of this disgusting dorm, and you would hear just glass bottles in there all night. Like, I used to collect things off the street that I could throw off the roof of the building into the pit. Like, I mean, just real high school stupidity of finding trash that you could break into a pit because you're an idiot. I brought one of those Piccolo Pete's into school, and we decided, let's throw that into the pit. And I completely forgot just how much smoke these things make. And it literally filled the entire first floor with smoke. Like, the freshmen ran out like it was a fire in the building. Someone thought a missile went off. Everyone kept their mouth shut. place was backwards. Not one person got in trouble, but it was definitely had that moment where you're like, oh, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Ultimately, Al-Qaeda took the blame, but it was all a Jew. It was a Jew who started it the whole time. Ooh, that's, yeah, that one go. I definitely had a bunch of moments like that. Just a bunch of moments when you're like a mischievous kid, where like when you realize that like the prank you were pulling has gone in a crazy different direction. I remember me and a buddy of mine one time, we prank called a bunch of teachers. I forget what it was. We got like a, that handbook with like teachers' numbers in them or something. And we were like, oh, we're going to prank phone call like a bunch of teachers. And then somewhere along the line, I mean, we were like in the sixth grade. It was like boys being boys. I guess we threatened to kill a lot of them. Like that was the prank. That was the prank that we came up with. Was like, I'm going to kill you and your whole family. And blah, blah, blah. And then you're like, oh, turns out that's a whole thing. That's going to be like meetings and neighborhoods and police departments are going to be kind. You know, but like at the time you're like, oh no, like in my mind, this was just kind of like, this is hilarious, right? Like, isn't this a funny thing to do? Yeah, those moments are fun.
I also got lucky on this one. I one time got my hands on an M80, and that was like,
you can't find
an M80. Yeah, all right. Yeah, yeah. So I finally got my hand on an M80, and it's like, what are we going to blow up? And there was this little park in Washington Heights down from this dorm that I lived in. And I strapped 4 cans of deodorant onto this. And we're like, we're going to go to the park and go firebomb, like just in the park. Like, we're going to look at this thing. And it was funny because the security guards that work there that we also bought drugs from in later years, because they were just 18-year-old hood guys that they put into Burns uniforms.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So a bunch of them came with.
I bought weed from many a security guard in my day. Security guard was it was always just some thug from the hood in a
burn security uniform. Yes, yeah. Yep. And I got lucky because I think this would have been a real problem that the M80 turned out to be a dud, but ran down this giant flight of stairs, put it down, lit the fuse, ran all the way up the stairs. We're all standing there waiting and just nothing happened, which in retrospect, I think was lucky.
Yeah, probably. Probably. Yeah, you know, we zigged when we could have zagged. That's the thing, man. It's, you know, I don't know about what it's going to be like going forward or what it's like right now, but it was a dangerous world for boys growing up when we were kids. Like, it was like, oh, man, like, it was, and I knew people who just literally zigged when I zagged or whatever, who just, like, got caught by the law, got in trouble with stuff, where you're like, oh, this could really mess your life up, dude. You don't want to be. But it's so easy. Man, when you're a young boy, you're just like, I don't know, dude, let's go have an adventure. This is going to be nuts. Speaking of young boys having an adventure, that's what Trump did in Iran, really. It was just a young boy having an adventure. Ooh, this will be fun. Smash it. But it didn't work out very well. By the way, it is, of course, this is a members only episode. This is what you pay for, this behind the scenes stuff. You never would have figured out what Rob was up to when he was a youngster. Put your questions in, Natalie, throw any questions you got into the, our chat here. I'll pull the live chat up and we could talk about some stuff. Rob, you had sent Natalie, if you have the email that Rob sent, I did love the, there's something kind of funny about Trump. So Trump is now, I'm sure you've noticed, Rob, Trump is trying to pivot very hard to economics. That's kind of his, like, he's trying to, like, not only did he get the message on the war and he wants to end that, but I guess that he realizes now that he's trying, or hoping at least, that the war winds down. Now it's like, oh, okay, it's a sprint to the midterms.
You so better now, lower those prices. Yeah. Gas prices are coming down. Why are you charging them so much at the pump?
Well, it's tough, Rob. From our perspective, or at least certainly from my perspective, it's like you see Donald Trump take the last 6 months and obsess over Israel's enemies in the Middle East. And you're sitting here and you're like, dude, we got real problems here at home. Like, could you focus on our domestic economy, maybe? And then he starts talking about the domestic economy and you're like, you might need to bomb Iran more, dude. God damn, just stop. God, oh God, is it awful? Let's go to the clip that you sent over, Rob. Natalie, it's in the email. I believe it's the second clip Rob sent, was the Donald Trump talking about interest rates.
Anywhere. It's all about the interest rate. Lower the interest rates, you can have all the housing you want. But you have to understand, I don't want to hurt people that own houses too. These people, for the first time in their lives, they have valuable houses. They become rich. I don't want to hurt them either. What you want to do is what good for everyone? Get the interest rates down. We have this numbskull that was the head of the Fed before, and he's a stupid person. And we call him too late because he was too late with the interest rates all the time. We need low interest rates. Low interest rates will solve everything. We'll solve that. Now, despite that, we're doing well with housing.
Can you just pause it for a second? It's so funny because all low interest rates do, Rob, as you know, is kick the can.
But they don't just kick the can. It also increases the prices on everything because you got more money available.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't say it only kicks the can. I could say one of the central things that lowering interest rates does is kick the cans. Because for those reasons that you mentioned, it's going to keep everybody buying, keep the markets hot for at least now. So yes, it might have pressure on more borrowing, higher prices, but you're not going to have a crash in the market while you're lowering rates. At least, so you're at least kicking that can. But that's the only thing it does. But to watch Donald Trump in his where, I mean, what can you say about this guy, Rob? This is literally, it's just government by cartoon character. He goes, they're very stupid people. Lower the rates. Lower the rates. Everybody wins. Lower the rates. All problems solved. Lower rates. Good. So that's just it. Lower rates solve all. And I mean, I guess on a very surface level, right? You can kind of see what he means by that, Rob. Like he did go like, well, look, he goes, I don't want to punish the people who want to buy a house. And the price of houses are very expensive. So that sucks for them. But also, I don't want to punish the guy who owns a house because it's nice for him that his house is worth so much and has gone up. So lower interest rates. There's your compromise. The guy who owns a house doesn't care if you lower interest rates. And the guy who's trying to buy a house likes it when you lower interest rates. Therefore, magic bullet, everybody's happy, everybody wins. It is identical to listening a leftist talk about the minimum wage. They just talk about it as if it's just like, well, here's the solution. Obviously, if you're a good person, you're for that. Make the minimum wage $25 an hour. What are you, an evil corporation or something? Obviously, you want people to make more money. And it does, not saying this is a full examination of it, but it does leave you, Rob, at least just initially going like, hey, is there any limiting principle there? Like in this framework in your mind, if zero interest rates are so great or lower interest rates are so great, and they solve so many problems, well, don't just lower them, right? Take them to zero. In fact, Rob, why not have negative rates? If there's, right? I mean, it's just more of the same good thing. Let's pay people to take out mortgages. Why charge them interest? Let's pay them. Let's pay people to borrow money. I mean, again, you almost just want to like start this conversation like, would there be any problem with that? Would there be any problem with $100,000 an hour minimum wage? Would there be any problem with a negative 20% interest rate? And if you start to see that there would be problems, maybe you'll start to realize that like, oh yeah, in fact, you're not really solving anything. You're just mucking around in the economy. That's all you're doing. You're just trying to fix prices in both cases, whether it's minimum wage laws or interest rates. Any thoughts? I could keep going.
Oh, I got a million thoughts. I think the actual line is lower interest rates fixes everything. And hey, you're going to create a bubble, stupid. For one, for two, it's it really just, I mean, because Donald Trump looks at it from, I'm a builder and I want the lowest possible rate. I'm the government. I'm trying to borrow as much money as possible and spend as much money as possible. So if you're raising the rates, you're just making my spending more expensive. And on the topic of housing, it's a real problem that government policy can dictate winners and losers. And lower interest rates really helps people in assets because it creates inflation and people that own stuff, they're not just better protected, but they get wealthier because their assets kind of just increase in price in tandem with the inflation. Whereas if you're holding cash or you're more like fixed income and you can't afford investments, you're just losing your quality of life and your living standard. But particularly on housing, it's an interesting one. Gene Epstein pointed me in the direction of a comic book from, I can't remember the guy's name, but he's cool. And it's basically all about how zoning laws are the big thing on housing prices. If you want housing prices to come down, it's just, which also kind of makes sense. Hey, I move into an area and we want to make it as hard as possible to build here or to build multiple things on smaller lots because I want to protect the value of my home. I don't want my neighbor to be able to knock down his house and put three houses on the same lot because now I got poor people living next to me and my house goes down in value. So there is a problem that, like, kind of once you've agreed on a zoning law, that will affect your home pricing, and then it does create a problem that you're essentially stealing from me that I bought under a certain set of circumstances. Now you're changing the set of circumstances.
Yeah. And even if you want to get even more, it is all very good points, but even if you want to get even more abstract with it, and ooh, I might get myself in some libertarian trouble with this, but I'm saying, so like in where I live, I've seen there's essentially, like, I guess, what is it? Like, not the city council, but there's whatever it is. There's like a group or whatever for my town. And they fight everything. They fight. It's constantly like a thing where like McDonald's or whatever wants to come in or some other like corporation wants to come in, wants to buy, and they fight all of it. They won't let it. And the people of the town really like that about it. It's like one of the things that they really like that they fight against. And even in a situation like that, I don't know if I feel like the libertarian analysis is as simple as, well, we're on the side of the big corporation against the town. You know, I look at it much more like, well, the macro economy is completely rigged on behalf of giant corporations. And then on the very local level, almost the only weapon that people have back against those corporations is their like local governments. And like, all I'm saying is like, things are complicated. I don't know. I'm sure you could make some argument about how like it might be better for jobs or something to have more development or whether residential or commercial in certain areas. But also, this is kind of why me and you are free market guys, is we kind of go, well, let people figure out. Just don't rig the system and let people figure out how much area they want to keep for themselves to be residential. I mean, I don't know. I think it's a complicated question. And, you know, I know when I, like up by Lake George, you know where that is, Rob?
I've never been there, but I'm familiar.
But upstate New York area, they have like all types of laws against like logging and building and shit like that. And it preserves the area. It keeps it beautiful, you know? A lot of people like that. A lot of people like keeping it beautiful. And anyway.
But just back to the Trump thing is that
yes,
if government's going to dictate policy, you are going to dictate the winners and the losers, and you kind of can't have both.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want everyone who currently has a home to continue to feel like they're wealthy, then you are not allowing the housing prices to drop where the people that don't have homes can now afford to buy them. And so what I'm hearing from Trump here, which I think everyone in office will likely be this way until the Fed runs out of tools and you actually do have a price resetting and a bit of a collapse. But it's essentially, we got to keep the bubbles going because I'm not letting anything come down under my watch, which really does showcase actually helping the people who have wealth and are in assets at the detriment of the people who, if you're working your minimum wage job, that means you're experiencing more inflation and you're going to have less purchasing power. And
That's right. That's why I said kicking the can, is because essentially what you're doing, it's what you're saying, is that you're making sure the bubble doesn't burst. But yeah, I'm sorry. Keep going.
And the lower interest rate thing for purchasing houses, and firstly, it comes down to even if you get loan approval. So in a way, you're actually theoretically helping the wealthier people because then they just have more access to capital at the lower interest rate. And banks might not necessarily want to approve loans to people at a lower interest rate because it's not worth the risk, which is why I think that's part of the story of what happened with the single family homes, that there was essentially free money to big companies to get into that market. And so they started eating up the single family homes because they had basically unlimited free capital against inflation. But
right,
a higher interest rate, in my opinion, and I could have the story wrong. I'm not a financial advisor or anything like that. But at a lower interest rate just boosts the housing cost, which means you're saddled with more debt when you actually go and buy a house. a higher interest rate at some point in time. The problem in this market is people can't keep their people can't keep their mortgages when they move. So there's a lot of people that would like to downsize, but they literally can't afford to because they can't afford the next house. And so it's what happened to me. I remember during the pandemic, used cars shot up in price. And I was like, my cars were double what it's supposed to be. Maybe I should sell this thing. But then new cars on the lot were also like 30% above markups. So you're like, oh, I can't capture the gain here because everything's just up in price. I'm going to end up spending more to get the next thing. I can't actually capture the increased value in my car right now. So a lot of people in homes in the same situation. I think that's in part why like not enough homes have gone on the market. But a higher interest rate is not necessarily bad because the interest rate's tax deductible and you're buying your house for less. A lower interest rate just means you're spending, you got more debt and you're spending more money on the home. Like it almost favors the bank on a bigger loan for a longer duration of time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, there's a lot of different ways you could look at this stuff. Like if you're going to say like, what's better, higher rates or lower rates, like in a very broad sense, I mean, well, I could put it like this. I could say, Rob, do you think that the American people have too much debt or not enough debt? You know, like if we're in too much debt, well, then in some ways, yes, you would want higher interest rates because that is the disincentive for debt. You're going to get more debt with lower interest rates than you will with higher interest rates. That's an iron law of economics. The same, you know, that you're going to get more debt than you otherwise would with lower interest rates, all other things being the same or something like that. But I think, you know, people really should read. I got to say, I was talking a little bit about Mises in the last episode, but, you know, I really do recommend people read his theory of, what was it? Theory of Money and Credit. And then his book, Socialism, and his book, Liberalism. Like he really is and then also, I guess like Henry Hazlitt and some other guys are great to read on this stuff too. But if you just, like, even if you just think about it like this, Rob, in the broadest sense, because this is Mises's argument for why socialism essentially is doomed to fail and why interventionism is essentially just soft socialism. Essentially, if you really understand his argument, it's that it's all just different levels of coercion. Okay, that's all. From an economic standpoint, all we're talking about is whether people are making voluntary transactions or whether they're being coerced. If it's full socialism, then they're fully being coerced. And if it's liberal interventionism, there's slightly less, but still coercion. So anyway, his point was that socialism is doomed to fail because they can't have a pricing system. They can't have like a price calculation mechanism. So he was making a purely economic, like not even slightly moral or just a purely economic argument was that socialism, the reason why you're going to have starvation and poverty and all these things is because you can't solve the price calculation problem. Only free markets, only voluntary transactions can solve that problem. And then his argument against like liberal intervention was that, okay, you can have, I think I'm doing this justice, you can have a mechanism by which you solve the economic price calculation, but you're constantly messing with it. So you're not solving it well. And the same reason why socialists can't have one at all, mixed economies just keep messing up. And anyway, I think if I'm describing this correct, like very basic in my own words, not his. It's like if you just go, what is a price? Which no one ever thinks about, but like, I don't know, if you're having a conversation like the minimum wage law or a conversation about interest rates, you might want to start with what is a price to begin with, because that's what you're talking about. They're prices. The price of the minimum wage is a price. It's the price that it costs to hire a minimum wage worker. And interest rates are a price. They're the price that people pay to borrow money. And what is a price? Well, okay, what a price is essentially is information. It's giving people information. And what you want for economic prosperity is for that information to be as accurate as possible. Because like, even when you start by saying like, do you want higher rates or do you want lower rates? I mean, again, Rob, if you're a buyer, you probably want lower rates. If you're a lender, you certainly want higher rates. If you're, you know, like depending on who you are, you might want different. But broadly speaking, what you want is your economic calculations to be as precise as possible. And by precise, that means like a reflection of what people want, people's desires. That's really what it comes down to. Because like, if you could imagine, Rob, right, like go hypothetical economy situations. Let's say you're like desert island economics, but let's just say, you're on a desert island, but there's like, it's filled with apple trees that make delicious apples. There's literally just apple trees all over the place to the point where the problem is that you got to clean the apples off of the ground. The problem is never finding apples. What's the price of an apple going to be? Like, well, maybe not nothing, because there is some intrinsic value there, but extremely low, right? And that price is going to be information that we got plenty of those. Don't worry about that. Don't put your resources and energy toward getting more apples, because that's covered. We have that, so it's very cheap. Now, if you were in a desert island where there are no apple trees, and in order to get an apple, it was a very dangerous boat ride and someone had to go, like, you know, like risk their lives in order to do it, the price of an apple is going to be what? Insanely expensive. Because you're going to have to pay that guy who doesn't want to do something really, really high to get him to risk his life. So that's also information. It's like letting you know, like, hey, it's probably not worth it to pay this much money to go get an apple. It takes a tremendous amount to get that. We have other fruits that are cheaper. You know, like, now, I'm not saying there's no other fucked up forces that affect prices, but the point is that, like, the only way to figure that out is, well, how do you figure out that when you had to risk your life to go get the apple, the apple's much more expensive? Well, the guy who has to risk his life is like, I'm not doing it for that. I'll do it for more. He has to be voluntarily allowed to either take it or leave it in order to affect the price. And so, like, in the same sense that almost everyone, now it's not a perfect science, we're all constantly figuring out our price, but if somebody else, you know, you might think, there's lots of people out there who are like, hey, they do a job for 60K a year, but then they get an offer for 75K a year and they go, oh, okay, well, I'm leaving that job and going to this job. And that's part of figuring out the price of what that person's labor costs. But so again, essentially, when it comes back to interest rate, with all of these things, what you don't want is a centralized body. And this is why Mises would say socialism was doomed to fail. Because, like, how are you going to be the Soviet Union and you're going to determine the, think about trying to determine, Rob, the ratio of what a bar of soap to a candy bar to a house to a car to a walkie-talkie ought to cost. Like, how would you even come up with the ratio of what those things should cost, what one should cost, what the other should? It's, as we all know on some level, the reason why me and you can look at, you know, go on the internet and see how much these things cost and come up with the ratio is because there's like a near infinite amount of decisions and variables and factors that go into these prices. So imagine one government body is supposed to set prices for everything. And then also they're not doing it through any real world input of voluntary transactions, these little honest components that let you know what people actually want. They're just dictating it. So they go, I'm going to come in, Rob, and I'm, because I'm such a good person, and I think, you know, it's the moral right thing to do is to let people have apples, is I'm going to say you can't charge a lot for apples, even though it's a boat ride where you have to risk your life away. Okay, well, what's going to happen there? Either you're going to quit, no one will actually work, things will break down, or I have to enslave you and make you take a very dangerous trip for no reason. Like, it's, you can't cheat the system. You want to get good information. And so what you want interest rates to be is what they would be under normal market conditions, which is, you know, we don't know. Anyway, that's a long way to just say that. But you want prices to be what they would be under market conditions. What should the price of an apple be? Well, on the island where apples are everywhere, it should be really fucking cheap. On the island where you got to risk your life to get one, it should be really expensive. What should interest rates be? Well, interest rates, the information that they're reflecting as being a price on borrowing money is how much money we have. Supply and demand, you know? And so does America have a lot of savings? No, we have debt. We have mountains and mountains of debt. So that tells you interest rates should be pretty high. And so the idea of trying to push them low. Also, Rob, we had 0% interest rates for a decade. What, like, the idea of trying to push this price low, this is like again, I mean, this is maybe it's too extreme of an example to kind of make the point well, but like, if you just had a shortage in some market, right? And so the price of a thing goes up. Like, we just have a shortage in laptops, so the price of laptops goes up. And going, well, I'll solve that problem by writing a law that says you have to, the price has to be cheaper. It's like, that doesn't actually solve what the problem is. The problem wasn't the high price. The problem was the information that high price was conveying to you, and that information hasn't changed. You just changed the messenger, essentially.
I'll add one thing to your Apple examples, which to me is the entire beauty of understanding economics, at least in my head, is that if at first the price for apples is extremely high because it's very risky to go and get it, and so the high price conveys the risk. It also means that the high profit means there's an incentive to figure out how to lower the danger because you want to be able to import more apples. And so while today you might look at apples as an unaffordable thing, the actual economic process over time should bring down the price because as you do it more, you learn things. You learn, oh, this is the safer route. Oh, there's actually less risk. You start bringing more apples in and the price drops. Mm-hmm. So it's like the very thing of high prices tends to fix its own problem because that means that there's good profit there and then more people engage in the activity and they have an incentive to figure it out, which then ultimately lowers the price.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. No, that's right. I mean, you can say the reason why so few people would go take that risk is because it's, you know, it's so risky. But the reason why the one person would, the person who will charge a $5 million or whatever to go do it, is because they're that crazy dude who will come up with some shit and try to make all that money and survive. You know, yeah. And then that is certainly a major driver of like economic innovation. But, you know, all this stuff, all this democratic socialist, you know, Mamdani's party, that's what the last episode was on, all these guys who have this energy, it's like, it is, and this is what I love about the Austrian School of Economics, and why I just love economics in general, and I think understanding, like, truly what the science is that it's weirdly, it is almost like they, like they're practicing alchemy or something like that. Like you're like, on some level, guys, it's like, this just can't be done. This isn't real. You can't, you know, all of it, really, all of it comes down to price manipulation. They're trying to change prices and different things. It's what all of these things are, right? Like, if they're saying free healthcare, whatever, in a sense, they're saying we're trying to make the price of healthcare nothing. We're trying to make the price of education nothing. We're trying to make the price of buses nothing. We're trying to make the price of your labor more expensive. We're trying to make the price of money, in this case, less expensive. They're always trying to manipulate prices. But that's not, again, just to think about this in simple economic terms, that doesn't mean wealth. Like prices, that's, you know, in the same sense that like, if you could imagine if we were all stranded on a desert island, you know, you and 10 of your friends or something like that, we're all stranded on a desert island, but one of us, let's say, had a money printing machine. It's like how much money you print doesn't have any impact on how wealthy you are. Or if you were just sitting there and then you were going to decide, okay, there's 10 of us on a desert island, we're all going to get together, we're going to vote on what the price of a fish ought to be, or what the price of an egg ought to be, or we're going to vote on what the minimum wage ought to be. Like, none of these things make you wealthier. What makes you wealthier is if someone goes, I'm going to build a campfire, I'm going to build some shelter, I'm going to go fishing, I'm going to go hunting, I'm going to go. What makes you wealthier is being productive activity. And so there's not, you sit here and argue over prices all the time, but like, I don't know. It doesn't matter if your house costs 30 grand or 700 grand. What matters is how valuable the money you were making in comparison is. And, you know, anyway, the problem with all this shit is a matter of economic productivity. And then again, I guess the only other point I would make is, which probably works better, probably makes more sense to people who don't read or think about this shit probably makes more sense making after now, is that even when Donald Trump says, Rob, at the beginning, he goes, well, it's all about the interest rate. Housing is all about the interest rate, you know, which is our whole goddamn economy, Rob, of course, is all about the interest rate that the Federal Reserve sets. And it's like, yeah, dude, that's a sign. That too is information. And that's information of a very unhealthy sector. That's a very, you know, it's when you have not just, look, obviously there are going to be some sectors where large capital is required and therefore people are going to finance that capital and therefore the interest rates are going to affect those sectors. But when you're telling me that interest rates are not just a factor, but they are the factor, like that is everything. Well, that tells me that you've got an inflated currency and way too much debt. And those two things go hand in hand quite often. It's like, oh, why are interest rates so relevant in the conversation about housing in America? Oh, yeah, because no one can actually afford a house, right? Nobody can actually afford a house. I couldn't afford a house when I bought a house. No one I know could actually afford the house when they bought it. I mean, don't get, you can afford to owe someone the money for a house if they give you 30 years to pay it back. But like, that's okay. Well, when you have an entire system, like, you know, built off that, where the, when the price goes higher and higher and higher and you have real price inflation that gets out of control, what also gets out of control is that debt. And, you know, as you know, Rob, and I'm not really particularly very good at math, but as you know, the thing about interest is that, you know, you could actually finance a lot of debt if the rate is low enough and the term is long enough. You know, like you could, you know, either of us could take out a $10 million loan and live with that. You know what I mean? If the rate and term were low and long enough, right? However, you mess with that dial a little bit and all of a sudden that could, you know, that could really destroy us. Like if it's $10 million in debt, but it's a 100-year paper and it's, you know, 0% interest rates or whatever, maybe me and you could make minimum payments for a while, but oh shoot, you spike that rate up to one. It absolutely crushes us because we never were supposed to be able to borrow $10 million to begin with. And so this is, anyway, this is the type of real, I don't know, I guess it's like, you know, look, I understand this topic is never going to grab people the way that transing an 8-year-old does, Rob. I know that. But it really is fascinating to me, and it really is important because it's, you let these charlatans start like messing with all this stuff, and you think it's leading to prosperity. But it's like, you're not doing any of that shit, man. You're just moving the dials and confusing people about how much they're being robbed.
Donald Trump is clearly in the position of let's keep juicing the thing and let nothing come down ever, which is not actually gonna help the poor or help industries make better investments.
Yeah, like look, man, I'm not saying we're ever gonna live through a time where we have another great political national figure. I don't know that happens. I don't know that the U.S. government is salvageable from like within the government apparatus. Any more than, you know, like the Soviet Union government was salvageable from inside the government. You know, it's like, this is going to be exterior forces and what happens is, I don't know. But if we were to ever have a president who was like, had some integrity, had some honesty, actually cared about the country, wanted to try to do things to improve the country, you would like, one of the indicators, one thing to look for would be, imagine a president with the balls to ever go like, look, we're going to do this thing and it's going to be really bad for the next 2 years, you know, but we got to do this now. We got to bite this bullet. We got to go through this thing that's actually going to be really bad in the short term. But like, I mean, I guess they were saying that about the war in Iran, short-term pain for long-term gain. Remember that, Rob?
Well, he walked away from that one because the short-term pain is a little too costly for President Trump.
Yeah, it turned out it was short-term pain.
He didn't believe his own message of that the short-term pain was worth the long-term game.
Yeah, it was short-term pain for long-term. All right, how much do we owe you for that pain? Sorry about all that. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's, I was saying on the last episode, which I think you would like if you listen to it, but there's, You know, there is, I was kind of picking up more on the theme that we had from Tuesday's show, but there is something where, you know, you really go like, I know they blame us like, oh, you guys are going to be responsible for Mom Donnie's guys getting in because you're criticizing Trump or whatever. But we're like, no, like you're going to be responsible for them getting in because you're the opposition and you're turning everybody off. And, you know, like it's your fault, which I think we have a stronger case for. But it is like, yeah, dude, I mean, you're sitting here, you're like legitimately socialism, one flavor or another of it, is like on the rise in this country. That's one of the things that the regime has left us with after the last 20 years, which is a pretty annoying thing. And like, you guys are the ones who are supposed to be combating that. And essentially your message is like, no, we got to do socialism for the Israelis. So we can't do socialism for, you know, whoever, Mom Donnie, the people of New York City or whoever. And it's like, yeah, no wonder you guys are losing. But if you were to actually oppose this shit, you know, that you probably could have a very pop, like there's an opening and a tremendous need for somebody to actually oppose all of this shit. But even when, I guess my point is just, even when Donald Trump says we need interest rates down, that'll solve everything. It's like, how can you meaningfully oppose Mom Donnie when you're basically saying you just need welfare? Like that's your, hey, we just need social, we just need you, right? We need you to underwrite the debt that I'm going to be incurring over this next year. I can't deal with the actual economic implications of my policy, so we need you essentially to subsidize it. So like, how are you arguing against socialism? How are you going to lead the charge against how destructive all of that is when you're the biggest socialist ever?
I agree with that 100%, is that you've basically just seeded the socialism storyline when you're engaging in things like tariffs and bailouts and I need more control over the interest rates, all of this stuff. And they got the sexier story for so I'm just saying, listen, I hate Mom Donnie, but if you're average worker or idiot in this country and you're listening to someone's pitch about what they're going to do for the poor and downtrodden, hey, I'm going to go steal the money from the wealthy who are being privileged by government. Yeah. And I'm going to institute legislation that makes it fairer and better for you. It sounds like a more direct pitch for I'm using government force for you. I'm specifically stepping into the market. I'm going to force the corporations to give more to you is better than the I'm going to get a whole lot of money to the corporations that hopefully they get you a factory job. Or I'm going to drive up all the costs because that's going to lead to your factory job.
That's right, Rob. Well, look, I mean, my father-in-law is he's a trucker his whole life. He had a union gig, and so he was a union rep for years. And so I've talked to him about it, and so he retired now just very recently, but he was a union rep with seniority, you know, like a senior worker. And he was telling me over the last 5 years, he worked for like a medium-sized trucking company. And so he said over the last 5 years, he's had to essentially whip votes from the other union members against pay increases that they were owed. So like this might sound kind of crazy if you're outside of the world of union jobs and stuff like that, but this type of shit happens all the time on unions. And essentially he's in the position where it's in their contract that they get like a cost of living increase or whatever it might be. But the company is very concerned about layoffs. And so he works out deals with management where he goes, well, look, if we balk at this cost of living increase that we're guaranteed, will you guarantee there's no layoffs or something like this? And so he'll say he's had, and the position he was in was he'll have younger guys who are like new on the job being like, hey, fuck that. No, I'm not voting for that. You know, like but this is in our contract. We get our cost of living increase. And then he's got to go, hey, dude, who do you think they're going to fire? It's not me. It's you. Like, you're the lowest guy on the totem pole. Like, if I'm doing this, so you have a job at all. So anyway, but by the way, I just bring up this to just bring up the point that there's like, obviously there's always in business, there's these balancing acts. It's usually how these things work out. Like, okay, look, labor needs a little bit more of this, but also management can't afford to do this. There's these bad, and there is. So like, for example, right? If you were, let's say you had a business and the workers are getting some type of democratic control, God forbid, Rob, and the workers are voting for themselves to get more money. And you might sit there, if somebody who cared about the workers and who cared about the company, you might sit there and be like, hey guys, don't vote yourself to increase your pay anymore, because forget like the moral issues. We're not even talking about like whose property this rightfully is or anything, but we're just going like, hey, the business is going to go out of business if you guys vote yourself too much money, right? Like a certain amount of this money needs to stay in the business, so we're buying inventory for next month. So don't spend that money on yourself, because if you spend that money, we don't have a business anymore next month, then there's no money for anybody, right? Now, that might be the correct answer at some point, depending on where the equilibrium is. But like, you'd be like, yeah, you got to leave some money in the business to buy inventory for next month. But then let's say you just knew that the owner's brother was coming in and just stealing money, just stealing $700 every time he came in off the top. And you go, hey, do you want to just spend that money on the workers before this guy just steals it from you? That kind of changes the calculation a little bit. You know, like it does. I'm not saying that justifies anything, but it does push people in the direction of this socialism, because at least like in some way, at least a guy like Mom Dami is saying like, fuck that. I'm going to get my hands on some of that loot and give it to some of you guys, you know, like. If Donald Trump is essentially saying, no, keep your grubby peasant hands off that loot, that's just for me and my friends, I don't think that's a compelling argument against socialism. You know?
I think we got some good questions here.
All right. Let's get to them then. What do we got here? Dave and Rob, what do you think of Rand Paul voting present on the War Powers resolution yesterday? Oh, God, Rob. What can you say? We had mentioned this before the show as a topic. I don't know. I'm disgusted by it. And I heard one of his rationalizations about how, no, after using all that force, then that's when you can negotiate really well. Says fucking Ron Paul's kid. God damn. Man, I just hope he doesn't run. Just please don't run for president. Please just take that back. I like Rand Paul. I have nothing but respect for his heroic father. I'm not trying to trash him. But first, by the way, Rob, is there even any evidence at all that that's true? We're in such a better negotiation position now. We got this. We got less of what they were offering, and it cost hundreds of billions of dollars. And therefore, I have to vote against, or I can't take a position on a War Powers resolution.
I didn't see that comment from him. The comment I saw from him was that essentially I've said that the power of war should be in the hands of Congress and that the president should not be able to make these decisions. I'm interpreting the way I understood his tweet, but at the moment, Donald Trump is trying to negotiate an end to the war. So because of his request to me, I would like to extend to him the courtesy of winding down the war. So it didn't sound like he was actually supporting the aggression or the presidential power.
No, he said it. What I'm talking about, he said in an interview about it later, but he wasn't exactly supporting it. He was weaseling around. Well, like now is not exactly the time that we need a war power resolution because we're negotiating with them and we have the threat of war. And so like he did say some shit worse than that.
I guess.
But anyway, yes, to your point, even that's stupid. Even that's stupid. The president launched an illegal war. Yeah, vote against it. Okay, yes, great. Is he trying to negotiate a way out of this? Great. Put that much more pressure on him that he doesn't have the option to go back.
I agree 100%. And I think, Rand Paul is the best in the Senate. I hope he gets Fauci, even though that seems like a totally failed endeavor that I have absolutely no faith or hope in. He's willing to play ball too much, which I think is what actually ruins him. I think if he was a little bit more of a voice for the principles and he stood his ground, I actually think the wheel would turn to realize, oh, this guy's different and better. And I think the fact that he plays the DC game, even in his own little way, in a soft way, and in this case doesn't want to be a thorn in Trump's shoe on a big issue, because I guess he doesn't want the wrath of being on Trump's bad side. Principles over playing ball. And I get that I'm not in his position. I haven't kept that job. He's managed to be a successful senator, but it's not about being successful in the job of being able to keep the job. It's about actually getting shit done. And, you know, as Massey said, principles over party. And, these messages to the general population are important. And, I think right now there's no reason to be playing ball or not opposing what you think is terrible.
Yeah, dude, that's right. And I mean, I don't know. You know, I've been thinking a lot lately because I've heard a few different people say this. And I argued a bit with Jeremy Kaufman when he was on the show about this, but he didn't, I don't know. I mean, I like Jeremy enough, but he seemed like he just didn't really want to, I don't know. It seemed like he didn't really want to argue about a lot of the stuff, even though there were the topics he suggested talking about. Anyway, the episode didn't do great, but whatever. But like, he had sent a clip to me of, I believe it was Chris Rufo making this point about him, that where he was like, hey, look, man, libertarians are like, look, you were junior partners in this thing with Trump. And that was kind of his analysis on Thomas Massey and the Libertarian Party and a lot of us. Someone also in that debate that Clint Russell did, I think someone had made that point to him too, where they went, look, dude, you were junior partners. I mean, yeah, Donald Trump came to your convention or whatever, but like, you guys, MAGA is this huge thing. Libertarianism is this tiny thing. And so like, you guys got Ross Fried and you got this or that, and that's what you get. And that's that. That's what it is to be a junior partner or something like that. And I heard a lot of talk around Thomas Massey, this type of thing too. Well, listen, man, the problem with Thomas Massey is it's just, he didn't want to play on the team. And like, look, you're going to get your little wacky libertarian things every now and then, but you got JD Vance. This is politics, man. This is politics. You got to vote with the team. And like, look, okay. But the thing is that I'm already, my retort to all of that would be like, Rob, I'm already well aware of where I am a junior partner and where I'm not. I'm aware. I mean, like, I'm a really radical libertarian. I believe heroin should be legal. I believe I have a lot of views that are clearly outside of the mainstream or outside of the Overton window that most people wouldn't agree with. And I go, okay, I recognize I'm probably not going to get that tomorrow. I'm probably not going to get all welfare abolished or all gun control laws or whatever. But Rob, when it comes to not wanting to fight the war in Iran, when it comes to wanting to release the Epstein files, when it comes to like saying like, some level of fiscal sanity and not going off the debt cliff, when it comes to like price inflation and money printing, just a lot of things. It's like, no, dude, we're firmly within the mainstream here. Rand Paul should be, the issues that Rand Paul cares about the most are overwhelmingly popular with the American people. There's no reason, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, no, fuck you. How about you're the junior partner here? Like, If you support the war in Iran, then you're the junior partner in this coalition. Why should he be, you know, going soft on everything?
I there's another part to that that just strikes me as gross, which is, you know, you're holding up politics as an ideal, as we got to support and maintain this system. So like when JD Vance says this is the way politics work, it's like, yeah, that's why this thing is corrupt. If everyone just goes along with, hey, I got to be on this team in order to win and keep my job, and so you support what the team's looking to do, which is downwind from Donald Trump, that's disgusting. That's exactly the problem with the system. You need more people with the balls of Thomas Massey to actually go, no, this principle is more important, and this party is fucking up right now. And if more people were able to do that, and we created a landscape where people could do that, we could actually have a better system. But it's like it's literally a den of thieves, and you support, oh, this guy stole more from that guy, but that's the way the game works. And I understand everyone else had to get stolen from right now. But the way the system works is that we steal from each other. And so that guy stole the most. So he's just the best at it. No, the point is, let's not all steal from each other and we can all do better. And so if the if you're just going to look at it as, well, this is politics, you're going, hey, I've accepted the devil's deal of that this is an entirely corrupt system, and I've chosen that I want to be a part of a completely corrupt system, and I want to win at the game of corruption, so I'm going to behave in a corrupt manner. No, that's disgusting. Then either have some integrity and don't do the job, or put up a fight and leave when you lose. But it's like, to just go, the way to win this game is to be corrupt, so I'm going to be the most corrupt. That's disgusting to cheer on. That's exactly what we're here opposing.
Yeah, 100%. No, 100%. That's the whole problem. That's the whole thing. You know, I remember, as you're saying that, it just reminds me, but I remember Ron Paul and Rick Santorum had this moment in, I believe it was the 2012 presidential debates. If you could imagine just like, the person in politics, there's probably never been anyone with more integrity than Ron Paul and never been anyone with less than Rick Santorum. But those two went at, so if you know like a little bit of this background history, but like, so in the Republican Party in, I guess it was in 96, the Republicans had what they called the Republican Revolution, where they came back and took Congress. This was Bill Clinton was president at the time. And they, or maybe it was 94. I can't remember. Yeah, I guess it would have been 94 when they had the big midterm victories. And the big thing that at the time was like fiscal sanity, fiscal responsibility. That was the big thing that the Republicans like to talk about. And so the Republicans, a whole lot of them, Santorum being one of them, had run on this kind of proto Tea Party, you know, like we're for small government and balancing the budget and all this stuff. And then they got in there and they were a big part of the people that, you know, they bragged about balancing the budget with Bill Clinton, which is kind of bullshit if you look into it. But whatever, they were like, that was their identity. We're fiscal conservatives. And then a lot of them were in Congress when George W. Bush came in the year 2000, and the Republicans controlled Congress and the Republicans had the presidency. And in addition to getting us into disastrous wars, George W. Bush just blew up the budget in every way. And so this comes up in the 2012 debate between Rand Paul and Rick Santorum. They'd both been in Congress this whole time. And so they, you know, at one point, Rick Santorum said something about how he's a fiscal conservative. And then Ron Paul pointed out that he voted for George W. Bush's like No Child Left Behind, like Department of Education thing that like tripled the size of the Department of Education. And he voted for Medicare Part D, you know, for this giant expansion in Medicare to cover in prescription drugs as well. And so Ron Paul's talking, what do you mean you're a fiscal conservative? You voted for all this stuff. And he literally says, I almost like verbatim, that he goes, well, look, I don't believe in any of that stuff, but I am a Republican, and that's what our administration wanted to do. And so you got to be a team player. And Ron Paul goes, that is everything that's wrong with Washington, D.C. And it was a just like the moment right there, like what you're talking about. Like, yeah, that attitude is how you get $40 trillion in debt. That's, you know, can just we, always going along with the latest thing. Lower interest rates.
Can we quickly take on the next question? I like this one.
Sure. The next one is
if
Trump gets us out of Iran with a somewhat friendly relationship and declares Israel a hostile foreign nation, would you change your opinion of him? Well, these questions are always, it's the way they're worded is a little bit strange. I mean, look, first off, that's a huge if, and then it's an if then with a huge if. So, okay, if that happens, would I change my opinion of him? Well, what do you mean by my opinion of him? I mean, yes, I guess in a way. Yes, if that were to happen, this humongous if that you just laid down there, yeah, that would change the equation a lot. And then life is complicated. Then all of these things are part of Trump's legacy, getting us into the stupid war and getting us out of the stupid war. And in fact, human beings are complicated enough that like, human beings could drive you into a burning building and then turn around and give you CPR in that burning building and save your life from the accident that they put you in to begin with. Like it's, you know, look, we're nowhere near him getting us out, let alone getting us out, developing a friendly relationship and declaring Israel a hostile foreign nation. Those things, I mean, we are light years away from anything like that happening. if Donald Trump were to, after this, let's, hey, if we're going to be light years away, let's like use an extreme to paint a picture, make it everything. He ends this war and slashes the military budget and ends our relationship with Israel and pulls out of NATO too and makes peace in Ukraine and makes peace in Palestine and fucking turns every economic indicator around, just does all of it. Would that change my opinion of him? Yeah. And that would change what his legacy is. And that would change. He would still be the guy who did all the stuff he did up to this point. As of right now, I'm not giving him a whole lot of credit for the disaster he created. But anyway, go ahead, Rob.
Okay. Sorry to put this guy on blast, but I did the I'm putting the guy who asked the question on blast. But this is the dirty trick of the Trump loyalist. And the criticism of Trump is you look at the gambles that he makes and go, hey, these are really risky and stupid. Don't make that gamble. If the gamble works, then you go, oh, okay, I guess that gamble worked. It was a stupid decision at the time, but I guess it worked. And these guys like to look at the gamble and go, well, if it works out perfectly, would you go no? And you go like, well, it was a dumb decision, but it worked out. And so, and specific to this case, firstly, Donald Trump needs to have what Dan Harmon calls a go into the basement moment. It's a story thing, but it's like he needs to have an admission of guilt. If Donald Trump actually reforms himself and goes, listen, I was corrupted by the deep state. I got bought by a lobby. I made a mistake. Yeah. We have to reform the system. I'd go, holy shit, Trump's a hero. He learned his lesson. But if it's still in this mode of I'm the most intelligent, I'm the greatest, I've done the best thing ever, then he still has that same ego and stupidity that got us into this failed war and will get us into the next mess. And so, yes, if the best case scenario comes out, I remember when I did Tim Pool, it was the same thing where I was trying to argue against the Iran war and I made the mistake of trying to get along with those guys. I just should have been harsher because I'm probably not doing the show again anyways, but Tim just kept rolling his eyes at me and I was like trying to get along and be like, this is his show. I'm not going to, but one of them's like, well, if Trump just goes in there and he just does targeted strikes and the regime instantly folds, then would you support? It's like, yeah, if the absolute best case scenario plays out, then sure, I guess it was a good idea. Now let's actually discuss the risk of if you think that's going to happen, because that's stupid la-la land of, yes, anytime if the absolute best case scenario, if the government made all of healthcare free tomorrow, but then actually figured out how to manage it so it was cheaper and more available for everybody by every single metric, would you support it? I guess if they could do that, but that's la-la land, and that's the whole reason that we argue against it, because we know they can't do it. But sure.
Well, also, in this specific question, it's also kind of like, I mean, we're extrapolating a lot from like one sentence, but, and I don't mean to beat up on you the way Rob does. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. We appreciate your support.
I see through your manipulative question.
Rob hates your fucking guts, I'll be honest, but I love you. But I think that there's almost implicit in the question is like, well, what if Donald Trump just starts doing all the right things now? Like, what if Donald Trump does something really heroic right now? And again, that could happen. Like, I don't know. I'll cheer him on if he does. Like, I'm not saying I will. I certainly wouldn't put money on it. But, like, you could, you know what I'm saying? Like, the guy who was, like, a bitter, reprehensible drunk who ruined his marriage and ruined his relationship with his kids and is now 55 and alone and, like, all this stuff, he still could turn that around and go do something heroic after that. That guy could rush into a burning building and save a baby or something. You know what I mean? And like, hey, thank you for that part. You did all this other stuff that was bad, but thank you for that. So I guess in a sense, I'm just saying, this isn't disagreeing with any point you make, but like, I don't know, Rob, like me and you will call balls and strikes. When Donald Trump does something good, we'll be the first ones to give him credit for. We did in the middle, I believe, of the Iran war, if I'm remembering this correctly. We did that one episode on the SPLC story. That was just like, yo, nice move by the administration. That was great.
But people,
you know, but I'm just saying, but anyway, my point is, anyway, to the point of the question, sorry, I'll let you go after this and then we got to wrap up. But the point is that, you know, Donald Trump could have just done all that heroic shit without launching this war for them. Like, there's no need, there's no reason why it had to go to this. It's not as if, by the way, anything Israel did in Lebanon, they're treating it this way, but it's not as if it was on some humanitarian level over the top of what we've seen of them for the last 2.5 years before that, right? Like, he could have turned on them at any time. He didn't have to do this. So he hasn't done the heroic thing yet. He's done the 180 opposite degree of heroic thing up until this point. So, like, anyway, if your question is, if he turns around and does some heroic shit, will me and you go, hey, after fucking up, he did some heroic shit? Yes. That being said, we're probably not going to focus on that until he even nudges in that direction. Final word to you, Robin, then okay. Let's wrap up.
Maybe this is personal and petty, but I think I stand by this. I need people to say I was wrong. And what I mean by that is, like, Tucker Carlson on the Iraq war goes, I was wrong and I learned from it. Barry Weiss on COVID, from what I remember, was pro COVID the whole time. And then at one point realized, oh, this is bad, and when it was kind of fashionable to do that or a little bit early, and then turned. But that kind of shows, well, unless you go,
I got to go look that up. I want to use that against her. That's good to know.
I seem to recall she was a late stage.
I think you're probably right about that. There were a lot of people like that.
Before it was fully trendy, but then went like all like, oh, you guys are a bunch of idiots and look how bad what you're doing is. But to me, that showcases the non-credibility thing, which just leads to being horrible on the next issue, such as being the new face of Israel propaganda. So unless you actually have a moment,
that it's a good, by the way, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, Rob, but you make really good points, but that's a really good, there's something really dangerous about letting the late convert become the leader.
Yes.
You know what I mean? The late convert, there's nothing wrong with them joining the team, but when they become the leader, they tend to already be incentivized to be like, now look, none of us could have known back then. You know what I mean? Type shit where you're like, hey, wait a minute. Actually, what you should be saying is like, hey, you guys who knew back then were right. I defer to you. Anyway, keep going.
No, that's the point. There's no credibility without the statement of I was wrong.
Yep.
And I agree that for every Trump loyalist who supported this war, if Donald Trump actually flips on Israel and makes the change and they just hop on it while they were all, you know, yelling at us that you guys are just Israel conspiracy, blah, blah, blah. Like, they can't just hop on. They have to have a moment and go, oh, I had faulty analysis for an entire year.
Well, because in a way, the question is asking, what would we say? Like, you're almost like asking, again, maybe we're reading too much into this, but you're almost like asking, like, would you admit you were wrong if something really good came out of all of this or whatever? But it's like, look, dude, what's good that's coming out of this is that Donald Trump stopped. That's the only good that's coming out of this, is that he finally stopped. You know what would have been better than that if he had stopped earlier? You know what would have been better than that if he had stopped earlier than that? And you know what would have been better than that if he had never done it to begin with? So, you know, like, could we admit we were wrong? I mean, I don't know, dude. Like, listen, fucking, let's just say, okay, I get real weird with this and then we do have to wrap up. But let's just say that one of the bombs we dropped created a hole in the earth and then it revealed that there was a dinosaur living in the earth that was about to pop out and kill all of the human beings. But because we dropped that hole, we realized the dinosaur was there so we can kill him. Like, let's just say by some stroke of luck, sorry for making it a dinosaur. I'm tired. Anyway, but let's just like say launching this war actually saved every human being. You know, is it through some way we couldn't have possibly known? Okay, I'll admit that. Ah, shit. Turns out it was good we launched that war. I mean, goddamn, we had no reason to know that, but it did turn out to be the right. You know, like, I'll admit if I'm wrong, but if all you got is that he stopped and then that's the big win, then no, still, we're still in the territory of you got to admit you're wrong. You know, like, he's got to admit he's like, in other words, Rob, there's almost a concession with your point that, like, yeah, we'd acknowledge that when you're wrong, you got to admit you're wrong. If we got things wrong, that if COVID had just morphed into some other thing that did only kill people who weren't locked down, it turned out lockdowns were the right move, me and you would have had to admit we were wrong about that. And so if we'll do it ourselves, I don't think that's crazy to demand of others. Okay, we got to wrap there. Love you guys. Thank you all for subscribing. Catch you next time. Peace.